Picture a young mother in 1960, standing in her gleaming kitchen with its modern appliances and pastel countertops. She has everything the magazines promised would make her happy: a devoted husband, healthy children, a beautiful home. Yet she's crying into her coffee, unable to explain the gnawing emptiness inside. "Is this all?" she whispers to no one. This was the reality for millions of American women when the feminine mystique exploded onto the scene in 1963. Betty Friedan didn't just write a book, she detonated a cultural bomb that named what had been unspeakable. Women across the country hunched over its pages with recognition and relief, finally understanding they weren't crazy or ungrateful. They were trapped by an ideology that defined womanhood so narrowly it suffocated the human spirit. The book sold over 3 million copies and ignited second-wave feminism, transforming how we understand gender, identity, and what it means to live a meaningful life. The problem lay buried in millions of minds, unspoken and unnamed. Suburban wives matched slipcover material and ate peanut butter sandwiches with their children while feeling a desperate yearning they couldn't articulate. Lying beside their husbands at night, they were afraid to ask, "Is this all?" By the late 1950s, this nameless ache had reached crisis proportions. Women consumed tranquilizers, drank themselves numb, or collapsed in therapists' offices unable to explain their misery. The women's magazines offered absurd solutions. Try a new cake recipe, have another baby. Nothing worked because the diagnosis was wrong. These weren't neurotic individuals. They were intelligent, educated women whose human capacities were being systematically crushed. "I've tried everything women are supposed to do," one young mother confessed. "I'm still desperate. I begin to feel I have no personality. Who am I?" The problem's insidiousness lay in its invisibility. Each woman thought she suffered alone, never realizing millions of others were asking identical questions. The feminine mystique had convinced them their discontent reflected personal inadequacy rather than legitimate human needs being denied. Between the 1940s and 1950s, American women's aspirations underwent a dramatic shift. In 1939, heroines in women's magazines were predominantly career women, nurses, teachers, artists, businesswomen whose independence was portrayed as attractive. These new women created identities separate from tradition, pursuing their own goals even as they found love. By 1949, magazines began celebrating occupation housewife. By 1959, virtually no heroines had careers beyond motherhood. The new housewife heroines appeared strangely childlike and dependent, with no vision beyond babies. In The Sandwich Maker, the heroine took home economics in college, never held a job, and struggled asking her husband for money. When she attempted a small sandwich business, her husband canceled her orders, saying, "You're a mother, that's your job," which she accepted with relief. This transformation was deliberate. After World War II, a concerted effort returned women home. The feminine mystique emerged as powerful ideology, insisting truly feminine women desired nothing beyond husband, children, and home. Career women were increasingly portrayed as villains, divorced, neglectful, threatening. The message was clear: ambition and femininity were incompatible. The feminine mystique gained authority by wrapping itself in Freudian psychology. Freud's theories, developed from sexually repressed Victorian women, became unquestioned dogma in post-war America, despite their cultural limitations. Freud viewed female psychology as determined by anatomy. Anatomy is destiny. He believed women's natural state was passive, masochistic, and envious of male genitalia. Healthy development meant accepting biological inferiority and finding fulfillment through husband and children. Women pursuing education or careers suffered from penis envy and neurotic rejection of femininity. These theories gave scientific authority to the idea that women wanting anything beyond motherhood were neurotic. College-educated housewives feeling unfulfilled were told their discontent stemmed from failure to accept their feminine nature, not legitimate intellectual hunger. Remarkably, America accepted these theories uncritically, even as European analysts questioned them. Psychoanalysts like Karen Horney demonstrated many feminine traits were cultural rather than biological, but their work was largely ignored. Girls raised to be independent were told by the most advanced thinkers to return to Victorian restrictions, their respect for scientific authority preventing them from questioning this regression. Despite record female college enrollment, fewer women pursued distinguished careers. Two-thirds dropped out before graduating, with remaining students focused on marriage rather than intellectual development. Campus culture actively discouraged academic engagement. Students avoided discussing coursework, some houses banned intellectual conversations, and girls maintained casual, sophisticated attitudes to avoid being labeled oddballs. Many deliberately suppressed academic passions, fearing intellectual engagement would harm marriage prospects. One bright Vassar student confessed, "I used to enjoy solving math problems, but now I pretend they're too hard when my boyfriend is around." Educators replaced college chemistry with advanced cooking, classifying abstract thinking as masculine while deeming intuition and emotion feminine. Two-thirds of the brightest high school graduates who didn't attend college were girls. Even women's colleges proclaimed they were educating women to be wives and mothers, not scholars. This approach warned that intellectuality leads to masculinization, driving bright women to flee education for early marriage, abandoning intellectual development that could have sustained them through decades of life. The feminine mystique thrived through advertising that exploited women's unfulfilled needs. Marketing experts discovered frustrated desires for identity made women perfect consumers, eternally seeking products to fill their emptiness. The sexual sell promised purchasing the right products would fulfill women's deepest needs. Ads claimed floor wax would make them creative, detergent powerful, cake mix loved. When asked why ads couldn't suggest women use time saved for creative pursuits, one researcher admitted, "The client would be too frightened. He wants to sell pie mix. The woman has to want to stay in the kitchen." Most cynically, advertisers targeted girls before they could grow up. One ad asked, "Should a gifted child grow up to be a housewife?" while reassuring readers that intelligent women find housewifery challenging and rewarding enough to make full use of all their intelligence. But can supermarket stamps truly use a gifted woman's intelligence while boys go to the moon? The answer reveals an ideology that reduces human potential to consumer choices. The solution isn't more marriage or housework. It's a life plan, allowing women to develop their full potential alongside biological roles. Women who pursued education and meaningful work discovered their relationships actually improved. Children respected mothers with authentic identities beyond motherhood. Husbands found engaged wives more interesting. Women's rights haven't been won. In nearly every professional field, women remain second-class citizens. Girls entering these fields must be prepared to fight discrimination. It's healthier to compete impersonally in society than for dominance at home or through their children. The time has come to break the mystique spell. The feminine mystique produces millions of young mothers whose growth stops short of identity. Your life isn't meant to be lived through others. Your intelligence isn't a liability. Your ambitions aren't symptoms of maladjustment. They're your humanity demanding expression. The question isn't whether you can have both meaningful work and relationships, it's whether you can have a meaningful life without both.